Ambition! Woohoo!
Hello, everyone.
Hello, guys. Welcome back. Super excited as usual, as you guys will know. This is Tiffany, and I've got Alex.
You've got Alex, as usual.
As usual. And today, a little bit different, actually, we have a wonderful guest for you guys. We have Gina Miller. I'm just going to tell you guys a little bit more. So from challenging the UK government at the Supreme Court to championing financial transparency, Gina Miller embodies fearless advocacy. Born in Guyana to a family of lawyers, a journey from facing adversity as a young student in the UK to becoming one of Britain's most influential voices showcases the power of principled determination. She's a mother of three. And Gina's path to activism began with advocating for her child. This personal mission expanded into groundbreaking legal challenges that made constitutional history, earning her recognition as the UK's most influential Black person by Powerlist in 2017. Despite facing intense public scrutiny and threats, she co-founded SCM Direct, launched MoneySheet.com to empower women financially, and established a True and Fair campaign to fight financial misconduct. Her story powerfully demonstrates how motherhood, far from being a limitation, can be a catalyst for transformative change. Welcome, Gina.
Hi, Gina.
Hello. Lovely to be able to join you.
We are so excited. And can I say, I feel a little bit like Krishnan Guru Murphy at the moment because I'm used to seeing you on the news. So I'm very excited to have you on here. I said I would simmer
I'm
it
not
down.
Very
We're trying to become. I was even telling my son about this. It was like, who? But you know, so he's only four, so.
Oh, bless you.
No, but it's really exciting. And I think a great place to be start will be a little bit more about your personal journey and foundation, because I think something we discussed was how you know, our childhood informs our future. So, do you mind telling us more about your background? You know, your father's legal legacy, your mother's emphasis on education, and how that sort of shaped your approach?
Yeah, it's. I think we can never underestimate, and we must never underestimate, how informative and formative the influence of our parents are, and the way you're brought up, and the values and confidence more than anything that parents instill in you, and the fearlessness, because it all of that comes from the way you were treated and you were loved and you're respected as a child. And I was very fortunate to grow up at the knees of a father who was very much saw the law as not just words on a page in a book or in court cases, but as something that was living, that actually created change and fairness and justice for people and alleviated their pain. So to him, the law and justice were living in communities, in people's lives, and wasn't a dry subject. And I think once you have that perspective and you grow up with that perspective, you see it as something so valuable and something that you need to go out and champion and ensure that people understand their rights, understand that they have redress, and understand that the law is there to protect people, not just the most vulnerable, but actually all of us in society. And my mother was quite different. She was actually a botanist, and she loved plants and animals. And I always say she was an eco warrior before the term was even invented. And to her, it was very much about, we must not take anything for granted. We must not take the lives of us around us for granted. And she would put away and wash every tin, every bit of string had a place that would be rolled up and used again. And I think that resilience, that idea that everything around us contributes to our happiness and our well-being, again, you know, to have that different perspective and different value system from two parents who were very vocal in sharing and very demonstrative in sharing their values with their children, meant that I grew up feeling empowered and feeling strong. And I think that is one of the most powerful things we do as parents, is, you know, imbue our children with that fearlessness and that empowerment. And it starts from when they're tiny, from the first communication, you know, you do with your child, and being an active communicator with them. And it's not just the parents, it's also other people around you, your schooling, you know, the people you respect, your wider family, because everyone gives you a different tapestry, a different input, and all of that enriches a child. So I think it's a really important thing. You know, they say in the first 2 years, your child's a lot of your child's character is formed. That's incredible. You know, the brain is a sponge. A child is a little sponge. They're soaking up absolutely everything. So whilst it's exhausting being a parent, you know, it's also incredibly powerful that you're forming another human being. And I, my parents were very conscious of that. And I've been very conscious of that as a parent.
I think for me, that is really, it's lovely to hear that. And I think for me, one of the really crucial things about being a parent is being intentional about it. So pretty much exactly what you're saying there, to really think about the things you're teaching them, and the fact that they do soak up everything, even things that you don't realise you're teaching them. My son, when we were waiting for the bus to go to, well, work and nursery, stood and stuck his hand out to hail the bus, and I thought, I've never taught you to do that. You've obviously just watched me doing it. And it does make you so much more conscious about what you do in front of them and being intentional.
It's also very funny when you hear your words repeated by them in their little, you don't realize that you say and do things, and then they say and do it, and you think, do I really do that? Do I really say that? It's amazing.
And I think on that note as well, I think it would be, as someone who's obviously brought up, you know, grown up children, I think it would be amazing for a moment if you could look back and maybe advise us parents who are in the maybe early stages. Are there things that you think we could do with our children?
It's hard not to give advice because, you know, everyone's experience is different.
Absolutely.
But I think there are some lessons that I've learned rather than advice, which is that... you know, you don't have to be present all the time. Don't be guilt-ridden. This whole idea that we walk around feeling guilty, especially women, if we're working women and we're juggling things, is to feel that we're not being a good enough mom, we're not there enough. It's not about the time you spend with your children. It's actually about the quality and the communication you have with them and how you impart that sense of confidence and love and security when you're with them. So I think I'd say try and offload that guilt. You know, it's a really difficult thing to do because we all walk around with it. And unfortunately, society piles it on us as well to tell we are not being good enough. There is no such thing as work-life balance. Everybody has got to work out what their own balance is. But this idea, I'd say, well, I mean, it sounds a naughty thing to say, but I often say, don't get bogged down in reading all these books about what sort of parent you should be, what time you should put them to bed, what time they would eat. You're their parent and they're your child. You're going to know them better than anybody else.
They're not going to do it anyway.
And they're not going to do it. Right? But, you know, then you just be the best. You will be the best parent you can be by being attuned to your child. And by not, the other thing I'd say is there is also a temptation to try and vicariously live through your children if you haven't achieved something or done something. And that is, I'd say, try and resist that. Your dreams and hopes are not necessarily their dreams and hopes because they're a little individual. They're not you. You know, and I do see that quite a lot of parents thinking, well, I wish I had done that. I wish I'd done that. That's what I'm going to get my child to do. Well, they might not want to do that. So that's sort of my broad one. And the third thing I'd say is remember, I know that this might seem obvious, but remember to look after yourself. It's not selfish to look after yourself and make sure you're well. Because if you're not well and you're not happy, and you're not listening to the inner voice, you know, we all have inner voices that tell us things, listen to it. You know, we are incredibly intuitive as women. Because if you're not well, the family doesn't work, the love doesn't work, just the practical stuff doesn't work. And children pick up when you're not happy. You might try and hide it, but they are so emotionally in tune with you, with the caregiver, they will know. And that will make them feel insecure and bad. So, you know, try really hard to look after yourself and not see that as being, or you feeling guilty that you're looking after yourself. Because if you're strong, you're feeding yourself, emotionally, physically, mentally, and you're well, you're going to be a better parent.
I couldn't agree with that more, Gina. I think that is often where the guilt comes in. But Tiffany and I went on a spa weekend and we both came back from that weekend saying how much better we felt, how much more patient, how fantastic we felt afterwards. I was much more ready to do the kind of imaginative play that I'm not a big fan of because I'd had that break from doing it. I think what I was going to ask you next, though, was, you know, obviously you are so well known in the UK for the legal action that you took around Brexit, around the sort of revocation of Article 50? That, you know, that is where most people listening to this will know you. And we had an interesting conversation when we talked the other day about how that wasn't really about Brexit itself, and what you were saying about your sort of background and the importance of, you know, our rights and our democracy. How much of that was informed by your background when it came to taking that legal action?
Well, having grown up in Guyana, just tell you a tiny, tiny, because we have time, potted history of what was British Guiana to Guyana. It was one of the last countries to get independence. So we didn't get independence since till 1966. So when I was born, we were still British Guiana. And it was a terrible independence, terrible transition. And we had a dictator who then, you know, turned our country, the communities, the six peoples, because we had a big black community from the slaves. We had indentured labor, so we had a big Indian population. Then we had a local population and a lot of, you know, Brits or Europeans. And basically, race wars were the things that he launched. And it was a divisive country with a lot of hate, a lot of division, a lot of violence. So I grew up seeing that. And I've always been aware of the fact that how fragile democracies are and how fragile power is, and that we have to always be alert to make sure that we are keeping power in check. So that's something I saw. And ironically, the reason I ended up in Britain is because my father, and who was obviously Asian background, joined together with a very charismatic young black professor called Walter Rodney and launched a political party against this dictator. And the dictator had kill lists of people that were going to be murdered. And my father was on that list, but my elder brother and I were on that list. And the reason I came to Britain is because my elder brother and I were snuck out and quietly sent to Britain to be safe. So ironically, the reason I ended up here was because of my father's political activism. And so I grew up understanding about the fragility of democracy and how things can turn on a sixpence and suddenly you end up in somewhere very different. And you know, I would argue we are descending into chaos and in the world right now. We've never been more geopolitically uncertain with the rise of the right and the people knocking on the doors wanting to take away our rights, especially women's rights and the rights over our bodies and our freedoms. And I think we are in danger. So I've always been alert to that. So when I saw the government, two governments, Mrs. May's government and Boris Johnson's government, trying to bypass Parliament and seriously diminish our democracy and go back to what would have been a form of autocracy, that prime ministers can make up decisions to take away our rights. Because both bypassing Parliament means that people that we elect don't get to discuss what protects us and the legislation and decisions by a government. And if you take that away, where is our voice as the people? So I've always been alert to that. And that was what was behind those cases, because we don't have a written constitution. If we have what's called precedent, so if a prime minister gets away with doing something, closing down parliament because they don't like the decisions they're making or bypassing them, then future prime ministers can do that. You know, and I give two which sound quite wacky examples, but if a prime minister got elected and decided that as a country we do not believe in climate change and got that through parliament, we as a country, that would be our belief. That is what we would believe, that climate change doesn't exist. Or if they decided, which unfortunately is being discussed in some countries in the world, is that all legislation against abortion should be removed, and they got through that parliament, or parliament wouldn't let them do that, and they closed down parliament and put it on the statute books anyway, that would be the law of our land. So, you know, it really does impact our lives every day, what's happening in that place. I know it seems when you watch PMQs, it looks more like theatre and pantomime than anything, but there is actually very, very serious job to do. And the decisions made by these people affect every single thing we do in every part of our lives. So we have to stay alert. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there are people who try and go against the law. So I was lucky to win, well, not lucky, but I, you know, because there were big cases. But winning both it's interesting because lots of people think I sort of popped up from nowhere and suddenly, you know, I suddenly realized how to do this, how to be an activist overnight. But, you know, you alluded to it. I've been doing this for 30 odd years of my life, and it started with my eldest daughter, who is now 36, because when she was born, she was starved of oxygen, and so she has special needs. And at that time, 36, 37 years ago, there weren't statements in place. It wasn't legally required for schools to provide and for governors to provide care and support for children on the SEND spectrum. And so I thought that was so unfair because you had to have money. You had to have money to go and see a consultant. You had to get that medical report to get any, and then money to get the support. And that just to me seems so wrong. Surely every child and every parent deserved to have that. So that's when I started my activism, trying to get legislation in. And I was successful in getting that into the 1996 Education Act, which then had provision in there for governors to provide special educational support. So it was very personal to me. It was a very personal thing. And a lot of my advocacy, be it comes from my personal experience, from surviving domestic violence to being a mother, you know, to I've campaigned against outdated formula going to third world countries, things like Ribena. There was this thing called baby Ribena years ago, which was just rotting teeth. So getting that to change that formula, to just pushing and pushing for things that I know from a personal experience, and therefore I can speak with knowledge and understanding and empathy to the causes that I fight for.
I think, thank you so much for sharing that, because I look at the context and where you are today. So it sounds like there were always steps there. There were, things like you said, the activism, fighting for your daughter, fight as a mother who obviously loves her daughter and wants the best for her, but also seeing that your action makes a difference. And I think, that speaks to the budding activists, right, in all of us. And I think especially as mothers who are naturally overwhelmed with responsibilities, it sounds like there is a role we can all play in making a difference to our community, to immediate things that we can change.
Oh, Tiffany, the women are so powerful because we have an innate ability to connect, and to connect in communities. At the moment, the way the world is going, I think community has become more important than ever, and grassroots is where we need to see start change and connect and counter what is happening at the top end of society. And as women, we can come together to do that. I've seen it again growing up in South America, in the women, the mothers who fought in Ecuador, who fought in Argentina when there were so many of their children disappearing. We're seeing it in Gaza, the mothers there. You know, mothers come together, and we have this. I'm not saying fathers don't have it, but we just have, because we give birth. We literally give birth to the next generation, to our children, but we give birth to the idea of community too. And what is so exciting is that you don't have to know how to be an activist. You can learn, and you make mistakes, and you need to know, depending on which campaign you're involved with, what your place is in there. Sometimes you're at the front of it. Sometimes you're the connector. Sometimes you can do something. You don't always have to be the voice and the front of anything. You can find a different place where you can contribute towards being an activist in a campaign that can be successful, because it takes a team. No one person is ever going to be able to do it on their own. But the exciting things are that you can learn to do it, and you learn from your mistakes, and you learn to do better. And the other thing is, it's like a drug. Once you get hold and you realize it's successful, you get the bug, and you just want to go out there and do so much more, be it in charities, in your local church, in your local community, in your school. All of that is activism, and it's in its purest form, because you're doing it in the communities that you live in. You're doing it in with the people you can help, and you can see the results of. And that's so incredibly rewarding.
I
I
think,
think, oh, sorry, go ahead, Tiffany. Go
no,
on.
sorry, just to link with, I think, I always think obviously this podcast being aimed at women. I really personally like the idea that, motherhood is transformative, because I think sadly we live in a society that almost seems like it hates women or hates mothers. So I think I definitely want to, sit on that idea a little bit about, how motherhood can be an opportunity for us to find our voice. to find something we can change. I mean, even starting ambition, I'll let you talk about that, Alex. Like, we were so afraid, man. We had like a Google Drive for like a couple of years or something. We're going to do this, we're going to do that. And it was so nerve-wracking to, you know, kind of put our voices out there and talk about something that we are clearly very passionate about and really concerns our lives. But since starting, I mean, we've made so much progress, but it was really scary. So I think I just want to say that to maybe anyone listening to this, right? Or any advice, you know, that you might have for someone who, you know, just wants to start something. This idea of how maybe at some point for you, it was a bit nerve-wracking, it was a bit scary, you know, but...
Oh, it's always scary. I mean, It is scary because society, as you're right, in Western societies particularly, we don't value motherhood enough. And I've always felt, you know, it is one of the most important jobs in the world to shape the next generation. And the stewardship we can show to not just our own children, but their peers and to our wider community is so important and it's so invaluable and it's totally undervalued by Western cultures. And economically, it is totally undervalued because actually the economic value that women bring to the community, not just from working, but from caring, takes it off the state. And that is not valued enough. And, you know, one of the things I'm very passionate at the moment working with on Manishi and our policy is to say that the government should be covering pension gaps in auto-enrollment when women take career breaks. You know, why are they not covering that? It makes no sense to me whatsoever. And, you know, we have a worryingly low population rate at the moment, or growth and birth rate. You know, we should be looking at giving women tax breaks if they have, you know, we need to be much more, we need to value women in the economy, but in society and socially. Mm-hmm. And the social norms and pressures we have on mothers is completely wrong in society. And it's such a valuable the undervaluing of women in society, in mothers in society, is something that has to be addressed. And, you know, when I see governments bending over backwards to, you know, do more childcare, more nurseries, women, if they choose to be at home, they're the best caregivers. Why are you not rewarding them? Why are you not paying them to do it? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever that is not an option. I'm not saying it's for everyone, but it should be an option.
Such a good point.
You know, we've got to get to that at some stage where and there are lessons to learn to other countries. So it's not, you know, that there aren't lessons learned, so we can see how that comes. And unfortunately, as we get as more and more mothers are becoming, you know, the term is sandwich givers, because they're not just caring for their children, they're also caring now for parents or in-laws or aunts or uncles or elderly. There should be a compensation for that. There should be a recognition of the care. Care is valuable to society, and therefore it's valuable. But women are giving it, they should be valued and respected. Can I say that's the other thing? It's not just about value, it's about respect. They should not be looked down on. There's this fact, I am so fed up. When I was going out in you know, I started in the city in 96. There weren't very many women in networks and events I'd go through in the fund management world that I was involved with. And I'd go to events, and unfortunately it still happens sometimes now, and I'm asked, people who don't know me go, well, you know, what do you do? And I see people who bring their partners, and I can see, or I'll overhear a woman going, I'm just a mother. And I'll make a beeline to them and I'll say, please don't say you're just a mother. You are not just a mother. And so we ourselves have to stand up and be proud of that and say, I'm a mom and I'm loving it. I'm doing a great job and I love my job, you know. And so we need to be proud as well of the fact. So we need to stand up and be proud of the decisions we've made. But when you then decide, you know, your children got a bit older and you want to do something on the side, you want to start a small project, you want to do a podcast, you want to do a small business, it's terrifying because, again, the structure, social structures are against you. Walking into a bank to try and get a loan to start a business, the stats are appalling at how few women actually are successful compared to men. Or, you know, going trying to set a network, or saying to newspaper, your local newspaper, I want to write a column. I mean, you know, and you just have to be, you have to push, because I almost think, take it for granted the answer will be no. And then you push again and you push again. You have to keep pushing because it's not you, it's them, it's society. It's not you. It's not you that's getting it wrong. It's not you that's failing. It's society that's failing you. And yeah, we are going to fail. But you know what? The best thing about failing is you can pick yourself up and start again. And it doesn't hurt you to fail.
That is so powerful. I think you've put it beautifully there about, you know, take the first answer as a no. I think we're not encouraged with that sort of talk as well. I think that I'm really what I'm loving about having started this podcast is hearing women encourage other women to go out and to make those first steps, to start things. And, you know, I was shocked when I had maternity leave and then came back and asked if I wanted to pay the gap in my pension, because I didn't realise that was a thing until I was actually having to pay it back. And we're so undervalued and we're not encouraged and we're not recognised and supported. What do you think are the steps that we need to take as a group? I mean, just before you answer that, I think from my point of view, I'm very heartened to see that women are starting to talk about the difficulties of working and raising children. I think before you heard people internalise it, they thought that it was them. And we still meet women who think it's their fault that they can't juggle both. But what you're saying about the system not working for them, it's because the system is set up to make you fail. And I actually loved what you said, Gina, about why are we not paying women to look after their own children if that's what they want to do? So how do we change the system? I know that's a big question, but how do we come together and do that again
comes from pressure and lobbying to your MPs, but it's about group pressure. And you know, the more women get talking, and these need to become normal conversations. So not just conversations in homes or groups of women, but we need to then amplify. And then you need to find the male advocates who then go to also advocate for women and for their daughters and for their wives and for their sisters. So, you know, we need to have male advocates. We need to have the conversation needs to become more of a normal conversation. And then that can grow into pressure to policy makers. Because the reality is we need women to be in every part of society, in every conversation, in every boardroom, in every place. You know, we're 50% of the population. We should be present everywhere. It's not that these places are exclusive and these ones are not, or these are male-dominated environments. And it's not, I think the things, because I'm a lot older than you guys, I think the things I would say that have changed and that really give me hope from young women now is that you've let go, I think, to more or less let go of this idea that there is a perfect work-life balance and you can have it all. I mean, that was a myth. There was no such thing. That was undue pressure to put on all of us. Everybody has to figure out what their own balance is, and there is no perfect balance that you do this and you do that. So I'm letting go of that is really important. And I think the other thing that I'd say we perhaps weren't so good at is having a different language about feminism, because equality is better than feminism. It's about equality, because the problem is you push back when men think they're threatened, or when any society or any group feel they're pressured and they're threatened. It's not about being better or about, it's just being equal and having the same opportunities and actually being able to support them. You know, most men feel if their wives are happier, their daughters are happier, their sisters are happier, then they're happier, their lives are happier. You know, it's about being working together for a greater good. And that's what we've got to do. It's, rather than doing it in silos, it's doing it together. But there are some really strong, there are really big structural things that need to change. You know, recruitment, you know, I think that AI is a real problem. I know everyone's advocating it, but I'm cautious in two main areas, because, for example, in recruitment, if we start going more and more into AI recruitment, AI is using data from the past. And if you've got an equal environment that they're taking data from, I mean, I've actually seen this in action, where in a particular company that trialed some AI for recruitment, it showed that all male groups raise more fees. That's because they have in the past.
Yeah.
And the algorithm kept picking all the male candidates because that's what the information, because it had fed in 11 years of data, but it was past data. So it's got inherent biases, and it's actually got quite a lot of minority biases built into it, not just gender. So, you know, AI, you've got to be careful when they're taking in these things because it's being based on past data. Obviously, it's learning all the time, but I think we just have to be very cautious of that. And then the other thing is the male dominance in AI and technology, because we do not have any sort of parity there. So if you have an industry that's very much a male-dominated industry, the people doing the coding, the people doing it are doing it from a male perspective. And so I do slightly worry that we haven't got enough women who are going into tech. So we really do have to make sure that we really encourage our daughters, our girls to go into tech and to be, you know, look at those subjects. So they're part of the people who are constructing the next set of social norms.
And I think that's so true, just because also women, in terms of women using AI as well, there's a big disparity between women actually using the end product as well.
It's actually quite shocking. It's quite shocking. And I don't think that's necessarily good and bad. But, you know, there are lots and lots of questions to ask for that. But I'd go back to a basic and say, I have a little bugbear. And you would ask about a little tip is a little bugbear. And I try and say this and everyone sort of stops. I go, when you knock on a door, I don't care if it's in a boardroom, in your boss's office, in a bank, wherever it is, don't say sorry as your first word. Yeah. We just have this habit of knocking on a door and the first thing we say is sorry. Why are you sorry?
Sorry,
try,
sorry,
really
I exist.
Sorry. Really try, think hard to stop yourself from making, from the first word out of your mouth should not be sorry, and to really consciously think of not saying it.
I'll give an example actually. Gina, we went on our spa break, we were held back because Alex's tires burst or something, right? It was your tires.
I had a
burst.
Flat tire when we went to go.
And then on the way, so we were held back, so we had to obviously stay back and wait for that to be fixed. And I remember,
and our husbands
we
had back. The kids, didn't they?
Yeah, so our husband had the kids. We were held back for like 2 hours, and I remember we just impossibly wanted to say sorry on the way back because we felt bad for obviously something outside of our control. And I remember saying to Alex, we mustn't say sorry because we didn't do anything, you know. It was just one of those default sort of, oh, I'm sorry we're late, but why are you sorry when you couldn't change that? And I remember just that being quite a key moment of like, we're doing ambition, we're learning from this, we have to apply what we're learning.
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, I was going to say, and the other thing is, you know, going back to being parenting is, you know, it's, and I know many people don't do it, but, you know, boys are allowed to cry and show their emotions and be just as empathetic and caring as girls and being just as kind. We shouldn't stop them doing that. You know, I remember very vividly one of, because Lana, my youngest, will be 18 soon, but when she was younger and one of her peers, a little boy at nursery, was going to have his birthday party and he wants to wear a pink tutu and you know, his big boots and cape and just whatever. And the father said, boys don't wear tutus. Aww. And I remember thinking, oh, that's so sad, you've already told him that. You know, if he wants to wear his pink tutu at age whatever it was, 5 or 6, that's absolutely fine. Why shouldn't he be able to, you know? But it's also, you know, the stereotypes come in very early and it's unconscious, a lot of it. We have to work hard that we are not falling into those biases and those unconscious biases as well. Is that, you know, the boys do this and girls do that. You know, it's allowing them to be the individual they want to be and to whatever they are great at. I mean, you know, as I said, my eldest daughter's got special needs. So her mental age, I suppose, academically is sort of 5 or 6, even though she's 36. But she's got special powers, which is her ability to smile and make everyone feel happy and just care for everybody are her superpowers. And she can go out there and, you know, she's got a little job and she volunteers. And that's the thing that makes her incredibly valuable, you know, and she's got such patience. So she'll volunteer in an old people's home and she's got the patience to cut up their food, to brush their hair, to read them, you know, little nursery rhymes, or to tell, she knows every nursery rhyme there is still, or all those songs. But because somebody in an old people's home is almost going through their second childhood, they'll sit there and do heads and knees and toes with her and they'll smile. So, you know, we just need to look at how we value people and what they're giving back.
I like that a lot because I think my daughter is definitely quite a strong character and she loves like standing on tables and standing on chairs. And I often find myself saying, I know. I often
find my statement of the century. Yeah, like a little force to be reckoned with.
I often find myself almost wanting to say "get down" all the time, but I wonder if I would say that less if it was my son, because my son, the opposite, is actually very empathetic, quite gentle, and it's interesting how. I mean, even just this week, I mean, I don't know if you saw, but Zuckerberg was talking about like masculine and feminine energy, and I know. Obviously, there's inferences to like gender, but it's interesting how we can have either in us. And it's about, like you said, just being us, because there is a role we're going to play. There's somewhere we can add value, just like your daughter is.
I'd give your daughter a make-believe, a toilet roll that looks like a microphone or a brush or whatever, and say to her, well, do you want to make up a play or make up a speech or whatever?
Yes. Get her to you all over that. Really, I can see the Oscar coming.
Yeah, Tiffany's daughter and my son are very alike. He's crazy and out there, and if we go out with the three of them, Tiffany's son's trying to shepherd them while they run off in different directions. And it's so funny that they have the same parents and they're so different. So
that's the thing I find quite, I have to say, I find that so fascinating that you can bring up your children the same way. And I've tried really hard not to show any bias, because I've got soon to be, as I said, 18 and a 20-year-old son. And I've tried really hard. I was lucky enough to have the two little ones a lot later. But I tried really hard to bring them up exactly the same, because they're only 16 months apart. But they are so different from the day they were born. She did not want to be held, cuddled or fed. He wanted lots of cuddle. I mean, my daughter sounds like your daughter, Tiffany. I mean, she knows she's scarier than me, as my husband says. And but she's always known from the moment she arrived, she knew who she was.
Yeah.
And she, and so it is fascinating. I find it fascinating how individual they are, and that nature nurture argument. You know, what is nature? What is nurture? And going back to one of your earlier questions, you know, I've got four siblings, but I'm definitely the most outgoing one and vocal one of them all. But on, you know, my parents tell me when I was like 3-4 at school, I was the one who was questioning the teachers and not taking anything for granted. So I've always had that curiosity in a way, and that pushing back, and that's not nurture, that's nature. You know, I was born that way. So, you know, it is a combination of both. And I often find, I was watching the other day a documentary on twins who were separated and brought up in completely different parts of the world. And it's fascinating when you see how the similarities, even though they could have been brought up, one in Australia, one in the UK. And I find that amazing, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, there's definitely something innate in them, isn't there? And I wondered if we could talk a little bit, because obviously during your High Court action against the British government, you faced a lot of abuse and, you know, people saying horrible things about you in the press, driven by the right, a lot of it driven by the right wing media.
Yeah.
How were you able to be so resilient and still keep going in the face of that?
I never expected it, because the thing was, I wasn't supposed to be on my own. One thing about going back to the case, the first case in particular, I was supposed to be one of four claimants. So the other three were men, you know, white English men who were very wealthy, very well known. But when we applied to court and the first bit of abuse came, the three of them stepped away, which was absolutely right for them, for their businesses and their families. And that was their decision. And so my lawyers, the lawyers said, it's up to you, Gina. If you don't step forward, you know, if you don't carry on, the case will fall away. And I was naive, because I thought, this is so important. Everyone's banging about sovereignty. They'll understand what I'm trying to defend. And I thought that lots of other people would join me. So I never anticipated that I'd be on my own. But every time I looked around, there was nobody there. I have to say, financially, that was quite a shock.
I bet.
You know, I it was my decision. It was my money. I earned it. And you know, I couldn't think of anything better to do with my success, or the fruits of my success. But being on my own, being a woman, I mean, you know, I actually had somebody who used to work at the Daily Mail, who actually said, Gina, you couldn't have made our lives easier. You're an ethnic minority. You speak with a posh accent and you've been successful, elite. You gave us everything. You were like the avatar of hate. He had to use those terms.
Wow.
You were the perfect avatar of hate. And I thought, really?
Yeah.
Do you not understand what you do to people's lives? But they didn't understand. In a way, it's a sort of game. It's to sell newspapers. And so I didn't expect it. When it happened, the social media is a very toxic place. And the advent of social media meant that I didn't expect to get death threats and my children to be threatened. And the result of it is that I was looked after by the terrorist squad for 2 years. And having to do things, the children were then, younger, 10, 12, to have to do drills with them for panic buttons and safe rooms. And, it was my youngest daughter suffered. I mean, her trauma from that is still ongoing, of going through all of that and thinking mommy's never going to come home. It was unbelievable. But I didn't have time to think about it. And so I was literally just going through every single day because it was coming so quickly, so fast. The court cases were happening. I didn't have time to think about it. And so I never read the papers. My husband would be the one who read everything and looked at everything. So I safeguarded myself by not reading anything. But once the court cases were over, my lawyers dropped off five big black, those arch files, A4 arch files of printouts of the hate, because we were taking then court cases against some of the newspapers and Ofcom and some of the platforms. And when I started reading them, I couldn't. I was shocked that that was the country I lived in. And the misogyny and the racism that, as a woman of color, it wasn't my place. I was only good for being in the kitchen or the bedroom, or that it couldn't have been my money. I wasn't bright enough. I couldn't be bright enough to have come up with this. That I must have been funded by people like Soros and whoever it was. All of it was made up, but it then fed other people. And there was so much of it that was shocking. But one of the times when I found out that Facebook had been discussing, up to 2,000 people discussing hiring somebody to kill me, and somebody sent us a screenshot or sent it to the police and my team, and the end result was that the Viscount who'd sent this up, a Viscount,
A
actually
Viscount, oh
went
my
to
goodness.
prison for 6 weeks, the Brixton prison, 6 weeks, to hire a hitman to kill me. And you just think, how is that possible? And that was the first time I'd actually set a precedent then, again, for the first malicious communication online for someone to actually have gone to jail. But there were seven other cease and desist letters. I couldn't understand it. I kept thinking, what is it that I've done? I just could not understand that level of hate. And I think that is one of the biggest worries. I worked on the online safety bill, which, by the way, is no just not fit for purpose and desperately needs updating. But the internet has unleashed those voices that were on the fringes of society, and those thoughts and deeds that people would never air in public have now become acceptable to be everyday conversations. And the problem is, because you can do it anonymously, it then there are some people who then take it to the next level. And we have to do something about that. The fact that my kids could be taken, I mean, there was one that they could, that because my husband's Jewish, but because they were Jewish and Asian, they were mongrels and they should have been put down at birth. These were the sort of things we were getting. And so I saw. And I nearly gave up. There were many times when afterwards when I cried and I thought, I can't do this. When it came to the second court case, I never ever thought I'd bring another court case. But when they told me, ironically, so it turned out that because I brought the first court case, I was the only person in the country who could bring the second one.
Oh my
So
goodness.
because I brought the first one, I could bring the second one. So again, it was up to me to do it. And I thought, could I deal with all this hate? And when it all started again, I thought, you know what? I have to trump those voices. So in an odd way, I went from feeling completely debilitated to being fueled by those individuals. Because I thought, how can we let those individuals be the mainstream voices? We've got to stand up. I've got to stand up. So their anger and hatred actually fueled me to carry on. And carry on speaking out, and it does up to now. So now I'm at a stage where I know it sounds terrible. I expect to get a death threat every day or two. It's become a normal part of my life now. And I shouldn't think it's normal. And I know I have to stop myself thinking that, but it's not just me. It's, so many female MPs, so many women who stand up. I know, a black CEO, I won't mention her name, of a very big corporate. She gets them all the time. you know, so, but we have to just be strong and steely. And it's, and I do not carry on because I'm fearless. I am not fearless. Mm. I am fearful of the world my children will inherit if I do not carry on fighting.
That is, thank you so much for sharing that. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I think in my mind, what I could see was you obviously facing everything externally and just going home to your family and your children. And there is, you know, there's a mother in you. And I see how my children look at me, and I can imagine how your children must have looked to you then as, you know, mummy. But you have been a figure of, you know, like just been publicly attacked. So I cannot even begin to understand how you must have navigated that, like the conversations with them or...
my daughter was the youngest one. She would sit on the stairs, yeah. And if I was going out, she'd wait for me to come back. And if I wasn't back by when she thought I was, she would, which she still suffers from now, she would get so anxious, she'd pass out, which she did quite a few times. She'd become so overwhelmed by anxiety that she, and so she wouldn't let me out of her sight for a very long time. And so, you know, people don't realize that's a sort of damage you're doing not just to me, but to my children, for them to worry all the time. And then my son, I remember at school, I mean, 12, someone coming up to him and saying, your mother's a disgrace. My dad says that your mother should be deported. And you just think, what? Yeah. So there was impact to them as well. And that was the toughest bit, actually. I managed to departmentalize and, you know, I could deal with what was being happening to me, but I couldn't shelter them. And that is a guilt I carried because I tried really hard to shelter them, but I couldn't always do that. Mm-hmm. And now we talk about it now that they're older and they're both quite activist and vocal in what they're saying and doing. And, you know, they have a sense of it's not about just going to university to work, or my son is at medical school. He's not doing it for the money. He's doing it because he wants to give back. He wants to look after his peers and his community. So the good thing is that they've learned and they have seen my activism and they understand the true sense of why, and they understand my heart of why I do what I do. And I'm so pleased that I can see in them that that's flourishing too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, thank you. I really echo what Tiffany says about you sharing that, because it sounds, you know, it's unbelievable to hear as somebody looking in on the kind of abuse that you faced and, you know, what that's meant to your family. But it's amazing that it has then fueled your children to go on and become activists themselves. You know, you're saying that you feel guilt, but it's obviously given them a kind of strength and a moral compass of what is right and what is wrong and standing up for your, you know, for what you believe in. But I mean, it beggars belief, really, that people would feel okay with saying those sorts of things. And I think your involvement in the online safety bill, and you talked about people being allowed to be anonymous and how the online safety bill really needs to change. And there's a lot of talk about that at the moment. There's a lot of pressure from parents because I think our children are growing up in the Wild West in terms of the internet and what they've got access to. What would your thoughts be about the direction that bill needs to go in?
Well, the worrying thing is that, you know, it's that in the push to attract supposedly technology is that I think a lot of legislation is going to get watered down in the US and here in the UK. And I think that's a real shame because it's things like, you know, we need to have, if you look at countries like Brazil, have already brought it in, Ecuador, Australia, they've banned social media for under 16s. Yeah. They've literally just gone and said, no, you can't have it. Which is extraordinary that they've gone to those lengths. And I think that's so interesting and important that we look at this, because things like cutting rooms. I mean, my daughter's shown me this. There are actually rooms that people go into online to show, and they're competitions of how you cut yourself and how you harm yourself. Yeah, there are some really dark, dark things out there. And the social media platforms know these things are happening. And the fact that they're taking down the fact checkers, they're taking down a lot of the people looking at pornography. You know, the pornography online that's now targeting 12, 13 year olds, it's no longer just 18 year olds, it's very young. The technology that means that you can actually, they can go in and switch cameras so they look into kids' rooms, all these sorts of things. We know how to stop them, and the legislation needs to be there to stop them. It is not good enough. It's not good enough at all. Anonymous, a bare minimum has got to be to get rid of anonymity, because all the research shows that people behave differently when they're anonymous. And this idea that it then takes away people who might need to reach out, be in domestic violence, whatever, it doesn't mean that you have to publish who they are. It's the platforms who have to know who they are. It's not necessarily about publishing it online, but we need to know what people are putting up there. And very importantly, platforms are publishers. They need to come under publishing legislation. So this idea that it's because they're different, they need to be treated differently. I say very simply, it's not the medium, it's the message. And if the messages are ones that contravene hate, pornography laws, child abuse laws, safety laws, then there should be sanctions and they should be taken down. We're making it far too difficult. We're making exceptions when there shouldn't be any exceptions. So platforms are publishers and they should be treated as such. Ofcom does not have enough teeth, does not have enough powers. Ofcom also needs to be, because you can bring in legislation, but what about the enforcement? So enforcement needs to be looked at, the funding of the enforcement needs to be looked at, and the algorithms, there's got to be legislation around algorithms. The algorithms that are there, that are seeking out in particular, I'll tell you one, I don't know if you're aware of this, but this is how, this may sound an extreme case, but the chatbots, there is a case of a young man, I think he was 16, who took his own life because he actually had a chatbot, an algorithm, pretending to be a girlfriend. And he was suffering from mental health issues and depression. And this chatbot kept saying, if you're feeling that bad, you should kill yourself. And he has. Oh, and his parents are now trying to bring this case as a case, a case that would set a precedent. But so you've got chatbots and individual pretending and telling people and preying on vulnerability. I mean, my experience on this and the reason I got involved in the online safety bill is because my special needs daughter, there are people, paedophile groups, who actually target people with special needs, and they specifically go and look for accounts for people with special needs. And they identified my daughter and her Facebook account. And I didn't actually know she had a Facebook account, but because she was going to college to learn to be independent, so she was doing something called life skills courses at university, at a college, a sixth form college. And so they had set up a Facebook account for her. And she was groomed by she and her friend, both with special needs, and they thought they were talking to young boys, you know, some people with special needs, and they were lured to Elephant and Castle Roundabout on a Friday night at 10 o'clock with none of us knowing. And it was a group of four men. And just because I have her on 360 on the app, that, and she was in assisted accommodation, and I thought I phoned to say goodnight. And they said, but she's with you. And I said, no, she's not. And it was pure luck. But trying to get that Facebook account closed down, because she'd forgotten her password and she's over 18, they would not close it down because they said she was an adult. So they wouldn't give us any information on who she was talking to. So again, I had to go to the law and I had to threaten them that I'd take them to court. And they then gave us information. But you should not be targeting people with special needs, targeting vulnerable groups, targeting children. We have to keep our vulnerable and our children safe. And these platforms are not doing it. They're not doing it. In fact, they're exploiting vulnerability.
Wow. I mean, that's a terrifying example, yeah. Gina.
It sounds like all of us have to work on our advocacy, because especially as mothers, it sounds like we will need to fight something in our children's life. Otherwise, you know, these obviously companies and corporations just have way too much power. I'm just conscious of the time as well, Gina, but I really want to talk about the financial empowerment side of it, because I know that you obviously set up MoneySHE because of the barriers for women in terms of, you know, finance being a male-dominated industry, the barriers for entry. So talk to us a bit more about that and, you, I suppose, your advice, practical advice for mothers and women to really...
Again, it's about self-worth and self-help and well-being. You know, finances, we can't get away from it. You know, financial security is so important, but we're so busy living our lives. A lot of women, understandably, think, well, the man or the partner, whoever it is going to, you know, needs to do some of the chores in the house and to help, and, you know, we'll leave the finances to them. But actually, you never know what's going to happen in the future. We hope for the best, but you know, we should be planning for the worst. And the fact is, the data is there, is that you know, most separations happen over 50. The pension gap is such that men retire with a pot that's six times that of a woman. But women, we live longer. We have more complex medical needs. We tend to be on our own when we're older life. So we have to start thinking about putting away money for ourselves. And if all we did was just start with an ISA, you know, something that's you just put away, there are these products that you can save in that are tax efficient. You get a tax break in and it's in your name. And the thing is, you have to have things in your own name because you don't know what will happen in the future. Don't have, you know, joint bank accounts are great, but have a bank account in your own name so you have that security. Because it's not just about when things go wrong. It's about have freedom of choice later. If you want to start your own business, if you want to buy something wonderful, go on a holiday, go on spa break, you don't have to ask your partner for money. It's your money. You can do that with. But the most important thing is your older self, putting away something for your older self and starting as early as possible. So with MoneySheet, what I'm trying to do is get rid of the barriers of jargon, language, make it easy, use technology to make tools that mean that women can start looking at risk, looking at and learning and building up their own confidence. Because the fact is that the public purse is not going to look after you. Your state pension is not going to keep you in luxury. Actually, it's not even going to keep you in the necessities. You know, and before you know it, you're older. You know, 20, 30 yeah. years have gone by and you've got another 20, 30 years. But it's not even for those things alone. It's also the fact that we don't know how our health will suffer. You know, one in four women will develop breast cancer or some sort of cancer. And that can wipe out going through chemo, going through treatment. That can wipe out 18 months, 2 years of your life, getting well again. What happens to you financially if you've been working? What happens to if you've got young children, you need to have extra support and care for them? You know, putting away money in something that's going to grow and give you a cushion is so important. So important. So I'd say think about having two things to think about straight away. I'd say start thinking about your ISA for you as an individual and for your children. The junior ISA, I mean, it's 9,000 a year, and every child from birth to 18 can have a junior ISA. And, you know, when people are getting older, if you're having a conversation with your parents, inheritance tax, whatever, you know, put in 9,000 for your grandchildren or for their niece or nephew, or whatever, and then birthday money, whatever, you just top it up to 500. I tell you, so my daughter is going to be, so I started hers, hers is going to be 50,000. Wow. She can decide if she's going to go to university. She's going to decide if she, you know, puts it to a house in future. But that money just builds up and it's so important. Set it up and leave it and let it grow and top it up when you can, just with whatever you can afford to. It's so important. It's so important for women to be financially independent. It means you are not controlled. You've got freedom of choice and you can do what you want when you want. And with that, and then when you have those rainy days or things don't go quite right, you aren't trapped, because the statistic is, and MoneySheet, we were quite shocked when we did this. So a third of women do not leave their relationships because they're not financially independent. Wow. So they don't leave an abusive relationship. A third of women, that's extraordinarily scary. High.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you think about the investment gap as well? Because obviously, you know, women might not have savings, but we've talked to another guest about the fact that women are much less likely to invest as well.
So MoneySheet, that what I'm talking about is investments.
Is this investment rather than savings?
Yeah, it's investments, because the thing is with cash, it's like, so you go to your supermarket and you've spent £100 today on your shopping. In 20 years' time, to buy that same basket of goods at the supermarket, is likely to cost you another 90%, so nearly £190. Wow. Because what you want is real returns. Because of inflation and the fees you pay on your investment, you need real returns. So you need to be able to earn that money. So that's really what you want. You want to have a decent standard of living in 20 years' time to what you have now. And that's why you need investment, because putting money away for cash, the rule of thumb is you should try and put about 6 months of your outgoings. So if you sat down and worked out what are your monthly outgoings, try and put about 6 months of that in cash so you've got that ready. But above that, you should be looking at stocks and shares, ISAs. So that's what I meant. Investing.
Yeah.
At the moment, the benefits of investing are predominantly going to men and not women. And they're trying to keep it. And it's that that I'm trying to do with Money She, is get rid of the jargon, get rid of and building up women's confidence and understanding so that they can get investments. Is about independence in the future. And that's the message I'm trying to get across to women, is that, you know, you've got to think about that independence, your own independence in the future.
Yeah.
I like that. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know we're kind of getting close to kind of wrapping this up, but I think a great way to sort of end this is to, we spoke in the introduction about the stage of life you're in. So let's end this in this sort of a reflective mode.
Yeah, it's quite, I mean, oh my goodness, how have the years gone? I know everyone says this, but, you know, when I was 40, I was like, oh gosh, I could do anything. I felt so empowered, so ready. But then when I got to 50, I felt so comfortable in my own skin. I didn't have, you know, I felt a lot less of the imposter syndrome. I felt so comfortable in myself. I felt really empowered. I remember my 50th birthday party saying to my friends and family, you know, I've been quite challenging in the past. You ain't seen nothing yet. But as I come up to, so I'm going to be 60 this year, and I have to say, it's different. The mind and body changes, and I think I'm much more reflective now, and it's a quieter confidence, but it's also a real, I'm coming, because the children are going to leave, you know, I looked in the mirror and saw my mother for the first time. I don't think I've done that before. And so it's that realization that in reality, I've probably got, if I'm lucky, if I'm very lucky, I've got 20 years, which seems nothing. So it's, you know, what can I need to find my own identity again. And that's where I'm working on at the moment. And I didn't think that would happen. So it's, who am I? So I'm now almost at a questioning stage now, as I get into six, thinking, what are my priorities? Who is it that I want to be? It is quite a different thought process. And I never anticipated that. I didn't, you know, I was going to be me, and I was going to be carrying on doing all the things. But the reality is that my body is not going to let me do that. Yeah. And so I have to find, it's almost rediscovering who I am for this last stage of my life. And that was unexpected. That is unexpected. So I think in your 30s, 40s, 50s, enjoy being at the peak of your powers. I'm not saying that I won't be now. It'll be a different sense of my powers, is what I'm reflecting on right now.
I think that's so powerful, Gina. Thank you for sharing such a personal reflection as well. And you've made me really excited about my 50s as well, because that'll be, you know, it's a little way off, but it'll be my next big birthday. So,
oh yeah, but it's
made
just
me excited.
You can honestly, being able to let go of a lot of the social norms and just think, no, I can't be bothered.
I'm not sorry for anything.
Yeah, I'm not sorry for anything. I don't have to apologize for anything. I feel just so confident, and the imposter syndrome goes, and all those sorts of things just become easier. Which is, yeah, it was a wonderful time, and yeah, enjoy it. I'd say absolutely enjoy it.
I think I've already started apologizing to my kids for the embarrassment I'm going to bring.
Tiffany. Well, honestly, I'll tell you one thing about me. Doesn't matter what it is. I'm normally the last person dancing. I dance on tables, yeah. I dance everywhere. Yeah. I never stop dancing. And so I embarrass my kids so much. I say it's the South American blood in me. But, you know, the thing you love to do, be it singing, dancing, whatever, embarrass them. Who cares? As long as you're joyous.
I'm a horrible dancer, Gina, but Tiffany and I were up on a stage dancing not that long ago, weren't we?
we'll have to release the video. We went to a daytime rave in Newcastle.
It was over 30s.
Over 40s? Was it over 30s?
Over 30s.
That was phenomenal. So, yes, I suppose the tip for everyone is
that go to this rave,
dance at the table. But thank you so much, Gina. This has been incredible.
And before we say bye, my dad said to tell you that you're one of his heroes. That's what he said yesterday.
That's so lovely. I have to say, I'll leave you one quick thing if we've got time. So I had lots of awful things, but I also got lots of lovely letters. And I got this letter from a father, which I have on my wall in the office, actually, which said, I wasn't that actively involved in bringing up my daughter, but having heard you talk about your father, I'm now going to be more involved in her life. And I just thought,
wow.
that was just wonderful.
That is lovely. That's really nice. Yeah, well, my dad, Paul Morgan, in case you're listening, Dad, said that you are his hero. So.
Okay.
Oh, bless.
That's such a beautiful place to leave it. Thank you so much, Gina.
Thank you.
Lovely to chat to you both.
You too.